Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 193 and it's the end of 1852. First off, congratulations to Tina Mklope, who is DSTV's content creator, podcaster of the year. I was so happy to be shortlisted and incredibly happy for her. Tina's African storytelling podcast is groundbreaking. Please look out for it on all podcast platforms. And a big shout out to all other finalists. I was amazed at just how many people in South Africa are making a living out of creating their own content, their own stories. Things sure have changed in the media space. Back to 1852. Planet Earth had seen quite a few interesting events in that year. Henry Wells and William Fargo put a few dollars together and launched Wells Fargo and Company. In Boston, Harriet Beecher Stowe published Uncle Tom's Cabin. Smith & Wesson, the firearms manufacturer, was founded and the Taiping Rebellion in China gained momentum. The British Parliament passed the New Zealand Constitution Act of 1852, which granted the colony self-government, something the settlers in South Africa had been trying to achieve for the Cape. The first Yale-Harvard boat race was held in 1852, and French engineer Henri Giffard made the inaugural airship trip, taking off in Paris and flying to Trappe. Leo Tolstoy published his first book called Childhood in 1852. Then a deadly tsunami triggered by an earthquake killed thousands in Banda in the Dutch East Indies, something we know today as Indonesia. This is where the echoes of history could be heard more than 150 years later, when one of the deadliest tsunamis ever recorded slammed into Banda Aceh province on Boxing Day of 2004, killing 228,000 people. Geology is a swine, and geological history definitely repeats itself. In 1852, France opened the doors to the dreaded Devil's Island penal colony, made famous by Steve McQueen in the movie Papillon in 1973. And 1973 was 3 years before 1976, when a postulation made in 1852 was eventually proven true. Amazingly, this postulation or problem is at the heart of our lives today. Let me explain how an apparently obscure event that took place in October 1852 led to a host of technical developments in the 20th century and continues to drive innovation today. And it has a South African link. University College of London student Francis Guthrie was studying under the much admired mathematician Augustus De Morgan, and he postulated the question of proving mathematically that no more than four colours would be needed to provide separate tones to shapes that bordered each other on a map. He thought about maps a lot, because Guthrie also studied botany and ended up earning a Bachelor of Arts and became a lawyer. Guthrie's postulation, almost flippant in its apparent ludicrousness, was far more complex than it sounded. Don't roll your eyes just yet. Hang in there. What appears simple eluded geniuses of maths for a century. Even Minkowski, who was Einstein's mathematics instructor, had a go and gave up after dismissing previous attempts as the work of second-class mathematicians. Little did the world know, but Guthrie had created a question that was going to revolutionize computer theory, amongst other things, and it improved sports scheduling and sorted out mobile phone frequency allocation, and is also the basis of how artificial intelligence works. Of course, just to add this twist in the tale, there's a South African connection. So, the radical idea is known as Guthrie's four-color theorem. The four-color theorem problem belongs to the field of graph theory, a branch of maths that studies the relationships between objects represented as graphs. Each country or region on a map can be seen as a node in a graph, and the borders between regions represents the edges connecting these nodes. The simple idea Guthrie had was that you only need four colors to create those nodes. But wait, don't fall asleep just yet. While the problem arose from map coloring, its implications extend far beyond cartography, because it also has an implication for scheduling challenges, ensuring that no two conflicting events happen at the same time, like in sports fixtures. You know, World Cup playoffs versus National League games, for instance. That's not all, folks. The four-color theorem is behind the assignment of frequencies in mobile networks. This makes sure that adjacent communication towers don't interfere with each other by using the same frequency. Guthrie's postulation is part of MTN, Cell C and Vodacom, which some of you may be using right now to access this podcast. It had even more of an impact on computer development because without the four-cutter theorem, modern computer chips would not work properly. The theorem ensures that no two adjacent components share the same resources. It took 123 years to prove the theorem, highlighting its mathematical complexity. And in 1976, after much gnashing of academic teeth for over a century, Kenneth Appel and Wolfgang Haken provided the first proof using computers, marking the first major theorem to be solved in this way. Their proof involved checking thousands of specific cases that could not be handled by traditional methods alone. This introduced a debate about the role of computers in maths, as many mathematicians were initially skeptical of proofs relying on computational methods. And the four-color theorem proof marks a turning point in the use of computers in mathematical research. It basically kicked open the door for computer-aided maths and led, yes, directly to artificial intelligence platforms like ChatGPT. Please, can we give Francis Guthrie a big round of applause? Thank you. Before everyone complains, this is irrelevant to South African history. Here is the twist in the tale. Our four-cutters theorem hero, Francis Guthrie, sailed to Cape Town in April 1861. He was to live in the Cape for the rest of his life, practicing as a lawyer, then working as a newspaper editor, finally becoming professor of mathematics at the South African College, which became University of Cape Town. He died in Claremont in Cape Town in 1899. Long before his four-colour hypothesis was proven correct. Because he was a botanist too, Guthrie made an extensive collection of the Cape Peninsula fynbos, which was housed as the Guthrie Herbarium in the University of Cape Town Botany Department and is used for teaching and reference. Now, back to the maps of 1852, which had just been marked with the newest independent state of the Transvaal in various colours. Next-door neighbours of the Transvaal took note. One was Mshweshwe of the Basutu, another was Mzilikazi of the Amandebele, and Mpandi, the AmaZulu. Simultaneously, a cry went up around the British Empire amongst settlers demanding self-government. New Zealand was not going to be alone in the moves towards proportional representation of some sort. Needless to say, most of these colonies did not regard the indigenous folks as having any right to sharing completely in the self-government idea, with some exceptions. The pressure on land across the world was growing, and in the Orange River sovereignty, it was on the cusp of causing a major war between the British and the Basutu. By the end of 1852, the turmoil of the Transvaal was turning into a major concern for new governor Sir Peregrine Maitland. He was trying to cope with the Eighth Frontier War in British Kaffraria, where the Amakhosa continued to fight for their homes in the Amatolas and beyond. After signing the Sand River Convention, the British wanted to shore up their northern reaches, and here Mshweshwe had been painted as the ogre by British ally Sikonela. Taibosh's Kora people and Morocco's Rolong were supporting Sikonela as he battled away against Mshweshwe for control of the territory along the Caledon and into the mountains beyond. Mshweshwe had relented earlier by allowing the Boers to move onto the land of southwestern Lesotho, a move followed by more turmoil caused by the British annexation of the Orange River sovereignty. Many Basutu turned away from the British because they saw annexation as a precursor to full colonisation, which is ironic because that's exactly what the Boers also feared. The early French missionaries had managed to secure a special place for Christianity amongst the Basutu, but now this relationship was being sorely tested. There'd been more than a decade of peace previously, overshadowed in the early 1850s by competition for land. As the Basutu lost their land and their security mainly to white settlers, they turned against the Christian message. Previously, it had been credited with underpinning the Basutu security. Now, Christianity was seen as a direct threat to traditional values, an opiate to lull the masses into a religious stupor prior to land invasions. More fundamentally, the settlers professed that Christianity was a religion of peace, but seemed to spend their time seizing land that wasn't theirs while waving their guns around. Hardly a peaceful Christian thing to do. British missionaries knew Mshweshwe had been hard done by, and like their French counterparts, tried to get the British governors to intercede and protect the locals, but their letters were being ignored by colonial officials. Take Reverend James Freeman, for example. He represents the London Missionary Society and visited Moshoeshoe at Tabo Pasu. He then accused British officials, like Major Warden, of imposing essentially in radically unjust, cruel, impolitic, unnecessary boundaries on the Basutu. Warden was defeated at the Platberg, Palmerstraße, in 1851. By the end of 1852, the former colonial secretary in London, Earl Grey, was being replaced as Russell's government collapsed. The new commissioner and commander-in-chief in South Africa was Sir George Cathcart. He had spent most of his first months trying to wind up the war against Amakhosa. Moshoeshoe, like other African chiefs, knew all about these political disturbances going on in the British Empire and used the instability to try and improve their local power. Empire officials like Hogg, whom you heard about last episode, had promised Moshoeshoe the British were no longer going to interfere in African affairs. Fat chance. Hogg died suddenly in Bloemfontein, heart attack, it appears. Shortly after that, Grey was then thrown out. Then Major Warden was fired. An almost entirely new hierarchy of British officials pitched up in the Orange River sovereignty, and they were not really interested in Sir Harry Smith's attempt at increasing the size of the British Empire in southern Africa. Moshoeshoe began to raid Boer farms in the Triangle of Territory between the Orange River and the Caledon River. Attacking the Boers, they saw as allies of the British. Moroka of the Rolong, meanwhile, had suffered a significant series of defeats. When his main protector, Major Warden, left the building, so to speak, Moroka was desperate. Sikonyela, Taibosh, and Captain Carolus Baikis of the Bastards took to raiding Moroka's people along the Platberg. In May 1852, Moroka decided enough was enough and attacked the Batlokwa people, killing many and driving off most of their livestock. Bizarrely, British officials believed that Moshoeshoe was actually to blame for all of this. Behind the scenes, Charles Mustaine Owen, who'd been sent along with Hogg to assess matters, was writing reports. In September 1852, he told Cathcart that the British were going to pay dearly for remaining in the Orange River sovereignty with all the anarchy, and the region should be abandoned. Cathcart had done his own risk analysis, his own SWOT matrix, and came to the conclusion that more than 2,000 British soldiers would be needed to be garrisoned in the Orange River permanently to cause peace. That was a lot of treasure. It was now a question of honour, how to leave. The British couldn't scarper too quickly because it would be a loss of face. So the Empire's technocrats did what they always did and would do over the coming century when they needed to save face before leaving. They fired up their army for a show of force before they left the scene. Unfortunately for Cathcart, this show of force was going to lead to the biggest loss of British troops in South Africa in a single battle up to 1852. Cathcart was going to be forced to fight his pie and vie, sent hither friends, fired. South Africa was proving to be a graveyard for the British military in more ways than one. Major General Cathcart was not a trifling, inexperienced youth. He had been the Duke of Wellington's aide-de-camp during the Battle of Waterloo all the way back in 1812. He travelled with the Russian army that chased Napoleon out of Moscow in 1814, but chasing Moshoeshoe was going to end in defeat, dishonour and dismissal. That's a lot of D's on Cathcart's scorecard. So let's begin the tale of the Battle of Beria. Cathcart's invasion was the second major European-led invasion of the Basutu Kingdom. On the 13th of December 1852, the Major General reached the Platberg with more than 2,000 troops, including cavalry and artillery, carting 6-pounder guns and 12-pounder howitzers. These were not pop guns and had been crucial when used against non-conventional forces by the British around the world. Because Major Warden had been defeated so resoundingly in June the previous year, Cathcart built up a truly powerful army. It was the largest British army to take the field in South Africa since Blobert, nearly half a century before, when the British had seized Cape Town from Napoleon. Infantry detachments included four companies of the Queen's or West Surrey Regiment, Three companies of the 43rd and 73rd Regiments, part of the 2nd Battalion of the Black Watch, four companies of the 74th Regiment from the 2nd Battalion Highland Light Infantry, and a company of the 1st Battalion Rifle Brigade. The cavalry included two squadrons of the 12th Royal Lancers and two companies of the Cape Mounted Rifles. This was quite some army. Together with the Royal Artillery and sappers and miners, it totaled 2,500 men. The Basutu King had at least 3,000 horsemen, many armed with muskets. It was this combination of horse and gun that was going to cause Cathcart quite a bit of trouble. But the Basutu didn't have artillery, like 6-pounder guns and 12-pounder howitzers. Surely they had no chance. At least that was Cathcart's assessment. Did I forget to mention that this was also one of the earliest known uses of a rifle by the British Army? How remiss. Another dubious record for South Africa, the first use of a rifle in real combat by the British Army. A quick word, the Minier rifle was a cunning invention by the French, who first used this unsubtle killing machine in 1849, following the invention of the Minier ball by the French Army Captain Claude Etienne Minier of the Chasseurs d'Orléans and Henri-Gustave Delvin, his friend. The bullet was designed to allow rapid muzzle loading of rifles and was an innovation that brought about the widespread use of the rifle as the main battlefield weapon, which it still is. The French adopted the vicious little rifle following difficulties encountered by the army in North Africa, where their muskets were overtaken in range by long-barreled weapons which were being handcrafted by their Algerian opponents. Long-distance musket snipers were making the French lives a misery. Military buyers around the world took notice. The Minier rifle was deployed in the Crimean War. Then similar rifles used the Minier bullet design, patent purchased, such as the Patton 1853 Enfield, the Springfield Model 1861, and the Lorenz rifle. These were the dominant infantry weapons in the American Civil War that created so much death and destruction. The awful wounds of these wars attest to the terrible power. The large caliber rifles spat out a deformed conical lead bullet that was half an inch wide, about 18 millimeters. Combined with the spin emerging from the rifling, created terrible wounds. Hit by one of these in the arm or leg, it was usually amputation. The wound was so bad. With that blood-curdling thought, back to Cathcart versus Moshoeshoe. The British commander summoned Moshoeshoe to a meeting. The Basutu King had heard what happened when an angry British commander pitched up with a large force and summoned a local African chief. Makoma had been unceremoniously seized, for example, and then, of course, Hintsa had been thrown into jail and then shot. Moshoeshoe thought better of appearing himself and sent two of his sons instead. The British were convinced that this huge army would overawe what they thought of as a primitive bunch of savages. To say that Cathcart then acted in a cavalier manner would be an insult to cavaliers, which actually was a name given to royalist soldiers who fought in the English Civil War. Acting in a reckless and nonchalant way is one thing. Acting in a reckless, nonchalant, and militarily stupid way is another. Moshoeshoe's two sons, Masopa and Sikonyana, listened in amazement as Cathcart laid out his ultimatum. The Basutu had 3 days to hand over 10,000 cattle and 1,000 horses. This was a third of the cattle and horses in the entire kingdom. Realizing that the very modern Major General George Cathcart may be suffering from some sort of dementia, or at least mental illness, the 62-year-old Moshoeshoe agreed to meet the British commander face to face, perhaps to gauge his mental capacities, and crossed the flooding Caledon River. Behind him, French missionary Kosali was shaking his head. He tried to stop Moshoeshoe, also convinced the British would pull a fast one. But it was fairly civilized, this meeting. Cathcart said he hoped Moshoeshoe came in peace, and it was now that the Basutu King made a famous comment that has been repeated in oral storytelling since. "I hope so too," said Moshoeshoe, "for peace is like the rain which makes the grass grow, while war is like the wind which dries it up." He also said one more thing, which is quoted to this day. "Anxious as I am to avoid war," Moshoeshoe said, "a dog, when beaten, will show its teeth." Nevertheless, the Basutu King said he may be able to scrape together the livestock, but needed more time to get the word out across his kingdom. "Oh no," said Cathcart, "I'll give you one extra day." What Cathcart didn't know was that Moshoeshoe wasn't a European king who could just grab everything his peasants owned. The matter of handing over so many cattle and horses needed to be discussed with sensitivity. Days of meetings, sitting together, spending time. You know, honouring his subjects by allowing them to complain about the British, then accept their gifts of cattle. The British commander didn't care about all of that stuff. Instant gratification was demanded. He was in a bit of a rush. Moshoeshoe rushed himself back across the Caledon and issued a general tax called a sitaba-taba and contributed a large number of animals from his herds. 2 days later, 18th of December, he sent Cathcart 3,500 cattle with a message, more were on their way. Meanwhile, a large number of Basutu cattle could be seen on the Berea Plateau between the Caledon River and Tabo Basu, and Moshoeshoe awaited Cathcart's response, not imagining what would happen next. On the evening of the 19th of December, Cathcart issued orders. It was time to invade Basutu land, without so much as a bayou leave. Because he was supremely confident, the British Major General decided only half his force of 2,500 would be required to defeat Moshoeshoe. The remainder, all four companies of the Queen's West Surrey Regiment, three companies of the by now highly experienced 74th, and part of the vitally important Cape Mounted Rifles, as well as two of his six-pounders, were going to be left behind to guard the Platbach. You could forgive Cathcart for believing that this camp was in danger, but most commanders would have probably taken most of their troops for an attack on a mountainous defensive position that was home territory of the enemy. So the Major General ordered that the men were to carry only 60 rounds each. No spare ammunition was carried from the camp. And just to cap off this poorly thought-out approach to the invasion, Cathcart broke his force into three sections. This is definitely not what is advised when attacking a well-prepared enemy in a defensive position on the heights. Military Tactics 101 advises the opposite: attack in numbers at a single point, by surprise. Two of the divisions would sweep around the Berea Plateau, which is a long, irregular tableland with precipitous sides. The third division would move over the plateau itself. All three would then coordinate their movements to converge on the Puttiastana Valley in front of Tabo Basu by midday. Then they join up and march straight at Moshoeshoe's stronghold on the top of Tabo Basu. Cathcart said later that he merely mentioned in passing that any cattle spotted should be rounded up on the way to the main aim of Tabo Basu, but his officers categorically said the Major General ordered they should concentrate on taking the herds. This confusion meant the overall strategy was not clear. As you'll hear in episode 194, the rank-and-file British soldier was going to pay dearly for this confusion, and eventually so would Cathcart. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about this episode. You can email me from there too and sign up for my little newsletter. Until next, tsamayantle.